Our guest speaker this morning is Reverend Darrell McGowan, who will be talking with us about mindful living and being spiritual. If we want to improve our golf swing, we practice. If we can't get out on a driving range or a course for several months, we understand that our game will suffer. Mindful living requires similar dedication. We cannot expect to be spiritually awake, consciously aware beings unless we practice mindful living. If we want to live well, we must be religious about being spiritual. Darrell is an ordained Christian minister, a Shinyoan Buddhist practitioner, a professional funeral celebrant, a spiritual director, a writer, and a father of two amazing young adult children, one of whom is with us this morning. His daughter is here. Darrell loves to write, backpack, meditate, run, laugh, listen, learn, and create desserts in partnership with his significant other, Susan. He's dedicated to living life fully and helping others to do the same. Let's welcome Darren McGowan.
If anyone were here with my daughter, she'd probably be placing a bet right now on whether or not I can stand still through an entire sermon. I'm used to roaming around when I deliver messages, and so I'll do my best to stay behind the podium and within range of the microphone so you can actually hear what I'm saying. It's great to be with you. This is one of my deepest passions. I have experienced my own personal transformation and been able to be a part of other people's transformations countless times through a dedication to spiritual practice. And it's a joy for me to share my passion with you and to share some time with you around this subject and to learn from you as much as you might learn from me. I want to thank Mary for choosing the opening words this morning. They were so appropriate for our gathering and for this message. And I especially want to thank Gary for the choice of Imagine and Shower the People. It's a bit telling when your music that you grew up with as a child begins to become sacred. I think it means that I'm kind of old. But I love that music, and it brings me back to some of the best part of my roots. I want to talk to you a little bit about what I prefer to call spiritual development. And while spiritual discipline, practice, or exercise are often used interchangeably to speak of ways in which we might try to engage life from a more spiritual perspective, I'd like to suggest to you that they're actually three different things. Spiritual discipline, spiritual practice, and spiritual exercise are stages in a developmental process. Spiritual discipline, or discipline of any kind for that matter, is the conscientious narrowing or widening of one's focus and actions to create or deepen awareness and action. So let's take a moment and unpack that. Discipline is about closing down our focus so that we're not distracted, or opening our focus so that we can take in more than what has become our habitual way of seeing the world. It requires discipline to do either. Now, since I am someone who experiences life from an extraordinarily active mind, I'm sure that had the diagnosis existed when I was in school, I would have been diagnosed ADHD. My challenge and my discipline is all about narrowing my focus. It's all about drawing me in to the present moment, because I tend to get called out by my mind and by things happening around me to attend to countless minutiae poorly, rather than to attend to what really matters well. And so my disciplines that I engage are usually designed to close the focus and to draw it in. For some of us, we have just the opposite tendency. We have a tendency to close our focus and to grow narrower and narrower and narrower. We have a really hard time seeing anything outside of the way we choose to see the world. And so we need to engage spiritual disciplines that broaden our focus, that open us, that crack us open, if you will. Once we've decided to engage a discipline, then it becomes imperative that we develop that discipline into a practice. A practice is undertaking particular actions on a regular basis for the purpose of preparing oneself to perform. My daughter is a dancer. She has practiced for so long that I got really spoiled when I was serving a church and she lived with me or near me. I would become inspired to preach on a particular topic, and on more than one occasion simply called Dominique and said, "I'm going to preach on such and such. Do you think you could do a dance that would bring that message visually?" And because she practiced at that time probably 12 to 15 hours a week, it was relatively easy for her to sit down with me, choose a piece of music, and create this beautiful visual presentation. Had she not practiced, though, it would have been nearly impossible. She endured years of feeling inadequate, of feeling uncertain about herself, of thinking that perhaps her desire to dance was misplaced entirely. But she endured, and she continued. And she took the disciplines that were taught her and practiced them on a daily basis until she became a very accomplished dancer, winning competitions, eventually dancing for the UC Berkeley dance team, and now choreographing for a couple of different dance companies, and moving to New York to take a job with a company that is turning dance into a fitness regimen. I'm very proud of her, obviously, but I have been inspired by her as well for her discipline and for her determination to practice. Not just as a dancer, but in so many other areas of her life. Once we have committed ourselves to practicing, then we must come into a place where our practice becomes part of our routine. We must develop a spiritual exercise. Exercise is the disciplined, continual engagement of practices to keep one in shape for peak performance. Dancing is a highly physical experience. That's why dancers tend to fall into a fairly narrow physical appearance. Now, more and more people are finding that they can dance no matter what shape they are, what size they are, and engage the experience of dance and gain from it. But if you want to dance on a professional or a highly advanced level, it requires that you maintain a shape that is designed for peak performance. Just as that's true of great athletes and others who are primarily engaged in a physical activity, it's true for any of us who are determined to live a more spiritual life. You can't really exercise until you have developed discipline and established a practice. But once you've taken those two steps, all of life can become the context for your exercise of spiritual well-being. So let's take a moment and talk about what it means to be spiritual. It means a lot of different things to different people, but I think one of the best descriptions of being spiritual is to be whole. Another good word is to be authentic. One of the dangers of the reading we heard in the opening words is to interpret those words in such a way that they become dualistic, that we think of spiritual as opposed to being physical, or being spiritual as opposed to being intellectual. Being spiritual is to be whole, is to recognize all of who we are and to embrace it. Being spiritual is never a practice of surgery. I remember when I first visited a counselor, I was experiencing reactions to life that weren't helpful to me or to the people around me. I found a good therapist and I told the therapist, "I just need you to help me develop the ability to surgically remove those tendencies in my life that aren't helpful. I just need to learn how to cut this stuff out." Fortunately, this therapist was a deeply spiritual man. And he looked at me and he said, "Daryl, I can do that. I can help you cut all this stuff out. And what grows in its place will be three times as difficult." You don't want to cut anything away. You need to come to a place where you can embrace it, where you can see that this is who you are. And you can begin to recognize that while it can pose challenges, if expressed in one particular way, it can become a great gift if expressed in another. You must learn to embrace all of who you are. And while that's true psychologically, it's even more true spiritually. The challenge for all of us is to embrace all of who we are. And that usually takes a lifetime. But there should be a significant difference between someone who has made a commitment to spiritual discipline and someone who has not. Between someone who has established a spiritual practice and someone who has not. Between someone who regularly engages in spiritual exercises and someone who does not. I think this is one of the big reasons that religious establishments are struggling so deeply in our culture today. I think a good part of our struggle as religious people, when we look around and see that a church that once was filled to overflowing every Sunday, or a synagogue that had Shabbat services that were jammed every Friday night, and is now experiencing pews that are half empty, lots of programs that go wanting for the people needed to staff them, a good part of the responsibility for that reality lies with us. Because we are simply not being who we say we are. People do not look at us and see what they want. They look at us and they pretty much see more of the same. Study after study shows that churchgoers have very little to differentiate them from non-churchgoers. There are as many people who claim to be religious in prison as there are in any top companies or amongst groups of entrepreneurs or any other group you can identify. For the most part, it seems to make very little difference in who we are to be religious. And I think that's because we've forgotten, to a large extent, how to be religious about being spiritual. How many of you brushed your teeth this morning? So we could say that you are religious about brushing your teeth. How many of you combed your hair? Or shaved your head? We are religious about all kinds of things. It kind of cracks me up when I meet somebody who says, "Well, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious." I want to say, baloney. We're all religious. Some of us are fanatically religious about not being religious. We all have disciplines which we have formed into practices and which we engage as exercises on a moment-to-moment or day-to-day or week-to-week span. The problem is that quite often those of us who belong to a church, a synagogue, a temple, or some other religious establishment engage very few disciplines that are any different from those who do not belong to any such organization. We are just as religious about getting after people who do not drive the way we think they should drive as people who haven't been in church for years. We are religious about all kinds of things that are not good for us and not good for the people around us. We are as immersed in this addictive society as the person next to us and find ourselves without capacity to step away from this addictive society. Even though every Sunday or every Friday night or every Saturday or on some kind of a regular basis, our house of worship provides us with instruction and sometimes even tools that will allow us to break free of our addictive society and live an entirely different approach to life. And yet, as someone who first learned to meditate and became a deep practitioner of meditation over 30 years ago, I must admit that on a particularly busy day, I still have an overwhelming temptation to make meditation the first thing I cross off my list. Even though one of my mentors, earliest mentors, said to me, when asked about his own spiritual exercises, "I meditate an hour a day unless I'm going to be really busy. And then I meditate two." And he was dead serious. Because he knew that without that exercise, that supported his practice, that was formed on the basis of his discipline, he could not be who he was. It's a beautiful idea to see each other's souls. But I would suggest that the spiritual path is not one that allows us to see souls as opposed to bodies, but souls that are embodied. Souls that are expressed through extraordinary intellects and wide open hearts. The spiritual path is one that opens us in three ways. It opens us first of all, mentally. It helps us to see the world differently. Practitioners of yoga or other Eastern faiths, including Buddhism, talk about seeing with the mind's eye, opening the chakra of the mind, so that one can begin to see the world in a different way, can begin to see from a much more holistic perspective. There are all kinds of practices that are designed to help us open our minds. But the ego is very cunning. And the more we work at opening our minds, the more we simultaneously close them and convince ourselves that this new, still very closed perspective is far more open than anybody else. We give a bad time to those minds that are closed to things we are open to. But we rarely recognize how we are closed to things others are open to. There is no box that the mind fits in, because the mind is a part of all that is and cannot be contained. And the challenge for us is to continually open. I'm reminded of a conversation I had with a rabbi years ago. We were working together in a hospice setting. And as I got to know Aaron, I thought, he and I have a lot in common. And since at that point I hadn't been nearly so involved as I am now in interfaith activities and hadn't really spent a lot of time with folks outside my chosen faith, that kind of astounded me. It was kind of exciting to know that the rabbi and I had so much in common. And so on one occasion when we both arrived for a meeting early and we had some time to kill, I said, "Aaron, don't you think God is?" And laid out my theology. I thought I knew Aaron well enough to be sure that Aaron would say, "Daryl, you are so wise. That is exactly how God is." And Aaron said to me, after I had pontificated for a good 5 or 6 minutes, he responded profoundly. As I concluded saying, "So, don't you think this is how we might best understand the divine?" Aaron said, "No." Man, I was devastated. I'm like, "Okay, so how do you understand God?" And Aaron said something that has stuck with me ever since. He said, "Daryl, I don't. And I never will. And I'm okay with that." Aaron understood that seeing with the mind's eye is always cracking open. Always. So that even the word God becomes a box that we need to be willing to release without being dogmatic. How many of us get all closed in on the idea that using the word God is somehow not spiritual? It is not easy to continually crack open the mind. It takes tremendous discipline. It takes practice. It takes a commitment to continuous exercise. The second opening we must have is we must open the heart. The heart is opened usually in one of two ways: great love and great pain. Our society thinks it's really good at great love. And we make movies about it all the time. It usually comes over us in a span of minutes, transforms our lives over a course of days, at which time we make a lifelong commitment to someone and live happily ever after. That's malarkey. That's not love. Let me tell you about love. And I may need to catch my breath a couple times as I tell you this story. My brother-in-law, Larry, died 10 days ago. He battled cancer for 4.5 years. My sister, Mary, loved him. And he loved her. When he was diagnosed 4.5 years ago, he was given a prognosis of 6 months. And he said he was determined to see his kids graduate from high school. We all thought that was really beautiful and terribly unrealistic, since they were in 8th and 9th grade at the time. My sister loved Larry every day. She got up every morning, quite often exhausted, and she loved her husband. She didn't love him with this romantic sentimentality that is often confused in our culture for love. She loved him as he lost most of his physical strength. She loved him as he slowly had a harder and harder time breathing. She loved him as he began to spend most of his time sleeping. She loved him and loved her children as they began to question what had happened to their father and why he was no longer available to them in the ways they so desperately wanted. She loved him through doctor's appointments, decisions, again and again decisions to pursue chemotherapy when she so thought that that was the wrong decision. She loved him when he was at his best and when he was at his worst. She loved him by leaving him at home and going to work. She loved him by coming home and devoting herself to him. For 4.5 years, one day at a time, she got up every day, suited up, and showed up and loved this man. Until 10 days ago, she held him in her arms and assured him that everything would be okay as he took his last breath. She has a heart space that is so wide open that it's all I can do not to leave everything behind and go to Portland to try to protect her. Because it's so dang scary to see somebody whose heart is that wide open, because she's so vulnerable. But that's exactly what she needs. Deep loss and deep love open our heart. And yet so often in our culture we do everything we can to avoid deep loss. And without deep loss, that means unintentionally, but very really, we have closed ourselves down to deep love. I live in the valley of the shadow of death. I do 150 to 200 funerals every year. This week I will bury a 51-year-old man, an 87-year-old man, and a 23-year-old man. I will walk with people in deep grief. I will help them find their way through the grief long enough to celebrate and to share everything that they loved about this person, to crack themselves wide open to the deep pain that is a part of their experience and the deep love that stays with them still. And at some point, I will remind them that there is no one sitting there who's thinking to himself or herself, "Oh, I wish I'd loved this person a little bit less, because it wouldn't hurt so bad right now." No, if anything, they'll be sitting there shitting all over themselves, thinking that they should have loved the person a little bit more. Because at that moment, they will know, perhaps in a way deeper than they've known in a long time, that no matter the cost, love is worth it. To be spiritual is to live our lives wide open, and that is incredibly difficult. Because whether we admit it to ourselves or not, we know. I've heard it put this way that I think really brings it home. That every time a mother welcomes a baby into the world, they agree with one another that one of them will watch the other one die. This is the nature of our existence. It is deep pain. And the only thing that brings us through it is deep love. To be spiritual is to open our minds, to open our hearts, and finally, to open our bodies. Eckhart Tolle speaks extraordinarily beautifully of the pain body all of us carries. We have this incredible gift called memory. But one of the challenges of memory is things get stuck there. We kind of have a Brer Rabbit experience of life. And if we're not careful, we get stuff stuck to us. And just as it's beginning to work its way free, we've been carrying it around for a long time, and now finally it's just about ready to detach, we get out the glue and paste it back on. Because we've become rather identified with that painful experience that's become lodged into us. And it literally becomes a part of our body. Talk to any massage therapist and they will tell you stories of people weeping uncontrollably as they receive a massage. Because the tissues hold a lot of our pain. We need to be committed to opening ourselves to deep healing, so that our body, our heart, and our mind are opened. And there are all kinds of ways to do this. The Baha'i Faith gives instructions to its members to engage both obligatory prayer and devotional prayer. Reverent words, which are addressed to God in the act of prayer, is one of the most important Baha'i laws. Christianity has all kinds of spiritual disciplines that have sprung up across its many different facets and expressions. Islam invites its practitioners into ritual prayer, salat, during which Muslims subdue all thoughts and concentrate solely on Allah. Spiritual practices are much more diverse amongst Sufis, including fasting, sama, which is Sufi whirling, and others. Judaism has deep practices that go back as far as the collective memory of Judaism allows. The deepest of one centering around the diligent study of the Torah. Buddhism has its practices. Hinduism, many of our new age movements have developed deep practice based both on Eastern and Western spirituality. And one that's near and dear to many of our hearts is the practice of Stoicism. The view that philosophy is not just a set of beliefs or ethical claims, it's a way of life and a discourse involving constant practice and training. Whatever tools we use, if we really believe that being a part of a church, being part of the Unitarian Universalist Church, being a part of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Fullerton is worthwhile. If we dream of the pews being full, of people being drawn to this place to have what we have, then we better make sure we have it, because we cannot share what we do not have. And that means each of us must find disciplines that draw us into the truth, that draw us into the sacred, that deepen our embrace of who we are, so that we might in turn embrace others as they are. It is not optional. If we want religious practice as we now know it to fade into oblivion, then we can simply dabble in those things that we find enjoyable for a time. But when they become difficult, we can cast them aside and find some other discipline that is far more captivating for the moment. Instead, the next time you find yourself saying, "I find God outside in the beauty of nature," ask yourself, when was the last time you devoted a day to the beauty of nature? When was the last time you engaged a discipline of a silent walk in a beautiful place for an hour where all you did was drink in the beauty and open your mind, open your heart, open your body to the depth of who you are? Whatever your discipline, recommit yourself to it. Let it become a practice. Let it become something you are so faithful to that just as you would no sooner walk out the door without brushing your teeth, you would not engage the world without having first engaged your spiritual discipline. Let someone see the remarkable effects of your continuous exercise, so they may look at you and recognize what it is they need, and may ask you how they might have what they need most. Yes, we need to see each other's souls, but we need to see embodied souls, all of whom are a part of the great mystery, all of whom are unique expressions of a power much greater than ourselves, and all of whom call us to be the unique expression each of us is, as faithfully as we are humanly capable. Amen.